about it overnight. We can circle back there tomorrow when we come back to review some of the issues we want to go to, okay? The next one, next issue is the land use zoning, permitted uses, and we had, I remind us that we had quite a discussion of that this morning, particularly the new development zones. So we've kind of worked that one pretty hard at the development, and we didn't talk about the management zones and the protection zoning. If you have any questions or concerns or you want to mention about that, I noticed there's some additional uses that have been added to the management zone that had been taken out in previous iterations, and we want to make sure you understand what those are. They look like they deal, one of them deals with the putt and trail system business, and the other one is to allow campgrounds as a permitted use in a management zone. So, and that would, and these management zones principally are in the easement areas, I take it.
They would now be exclusively in the easement areas, as we're recommending to remove the MGN zones and put them either into conservation or into development.
Or into development, okay.
Yeah.
Like at Beaver Cove, for example, right. We're recommending those two zones be development zones instead.
So there wouldn't be management, there wouldn't be campgrounds allowed on those zones at this point, then?
Well, as a permitted use, there probably could be.
In a development zone?
In a development zone.
Oh, they are allowed in that new development zone?
I believe campgrounds are typically allowed in a development zone, and we would continue that recommendation.
How about the MGNM? Is that's the modified version from Plum Creek? You're going to keep that as is?
There would really be no need for that MGNM zone. We would apply current LURC MGN zoning as it applies to the jurisdiction beneath the conservation easement areas.
Okay.
With a couple of modifications, which are listed on page 53.
So what then would you call that? Would it be an MGNM? Because it has those modifications.
We're going to have to come up with a creative name for it.
Yeah, okay.
MMHGN.
There you go.
Okay. Anything else on those that... Any concerns about the protection zones, particularly those embedded in the development area, which were proposing to be frozen, the boundaries are proposing to be frozen, right? If not, the staff isn't going to be insulted if we don't ask them any questions, so.
That's fine.
They won't be.
Is there anything about protection zones that we need to talk about? There are some changes to those zones as well, right?
Yeah, we have made several recommended changes to how to deal with protection zones that are surrounded by or adjacent to development areas. And if you'd like a quick overview, Ron can provide that.
25 words or less?
The 25 words or less is... this testimony was all labeled, quote, freezing protection zones. Mm-hmm. What was actually being proposed by Plum Creek is broken down as to 1, 2, and 3 on the left side. You're balancing competing policy goals here.
What page are you on?
I'm on page 54, Commissioner White. In the 25 words or less, staff consultant efforts on page 54 were to capture and make enforceable the testimony that came in from Councilors Kraft and Hempelman right at the end of the fourth week of party testimony as to what Plum Creek was prepared to do in terms of complying with laws that might be changed at the time. So I'm happy to answer any questions on that, but that's what we tried to capture. And to essentially put a development application through its paces, applying the standard that they articulated that we attempted to capture in footnote 61.
And was the natural resources inventory something that was recently added?
That inventory would come in at subdivision phase, so you would be able to see exactly what's there and what current law would protect that might be over and above the, quote, frozen protection zones for which they are proposing to meet the requirements one way or the other. Okay. So you'd have that in front of you. Right. It would be transparent. Mm-hmm. It would be visible.
Thank you.
So I guess the idea is regardless of whether there's a protection zone or not, at the time of the application and the applicant proposes to meet whatever standards apply inside and outside of the P-zone.
Well, meet them, but as defined by our language, which is they could demonstrate that they're not important and don't need to be met,
mm-hmm.
That the protections are there, or there are other ways to meet the intent of it. But they have to address the protections that are in place at the time. And they can't just say, sorry, those are new, those weren't here 25 years ago, get lost.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other side of that, which we just stated on page 55, is that they're proposing no alteration in protection zones in the easement areas. This is, as you said in your introduction, this is within the development zones or, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The next one is the design components within development areas. Did we talk about this earlier? Some parts of it, I guess.
Yes, Evan went through a brief overview of our thoughts on the long-term development plan.
He's
gone through that in some detail already. And we have had discussions on both the excess lands issues related to expanding the balance easement upon build-out, as well as the standards, the changes proposed to Section 1025Q3, which are the subdivision layout and design standards, which I've flagged as an item to circle back to tomorrow.
Yeah. Gotta,
sorry. I will try to be a little louder.
Yeah, get right up the microphone, Arga.
Will do.
Aga, could you repeat that?
Sure.
I think the fans are blowing, and that's actually part of it.
Yeah, it's gotten a little louder with the air conditioning in here, but I think we all appreciated being on today.
Yes.
Evan has gone through a brief description of the long-term development plan. I believe it was in the context of the Big Moose Mountain discussion, and in the context of Rockwood and Blue Ridge, and that's where the minimum land reservation requirement comes in as part of our recommendations. And we've also had some opportunity to discuss the rationale for our recommendation to eliminate the expansion of the balance easement at build-out, which is on page 61. And lastly, I have flagged for further discussion tomorrow the recommendation regarding the design standards 1025Q3. So I think that's the current status of discussions on this topic.
There's one point here that Commissioner Kurtz brought up early today on employee housing and the interpretation that we said we'd get back to. So I just want to do that. That's on page 58, Commissioner. Recommendation, or not recommendation, but element number four. Four development areas in which resort accommodations are proposed. A demonstration that it meets the created demand for employee housing for temporary and seasonal employees. And I think you had a question about what that language, the intent of that language, or I can't remember. I know
metric.
I said we...
The metric.
I think I had a question about who determines the need or how is that determined to be sure that if it's that if the need is there, it's more than a like there's a difference I think in my mind between a need and a want or a demand. But if there's a need, if you've got people who are traveling 40, 50 miles to come or 30 miles, whatever it is, to come work at a resort. In my mind, there's a need to house them there so that they're not paying half their wages just getting to and from work. But that's just in my mind. I don't know how you determine need for employee housing, and just wanted to know what mechanism that would be.
That's a good question. I assume what would happen, never having done this before, I assume what would happen, going back to Commissioner Laverty's apparently either favored or least favored word, there's a metric here that you look at standalone resorts, whether it's Sunday River or Sugarloaf or in Ogunquit or wherever, and the number of seasonal employees that will be housed, their wage structure, a percentage that can be given towards housing. You do a survey in the area of rental or other housing within a reasonable catchment area that's available or not, that's affordable. And then they will make a showing of whether sufficient units are available or if not, and what kind of dormitory or multi-bed or whatever kind of structure they're going to house people in. My sense is this is pretty standard fare at this point, especially when, as we know, it's often not 30, 40, 50 miles away. It's 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 miles away where people are coming from on guest visas.
Commissioner Kurtz, what I would suggest is that if the commission finds this recommendation acceptable and necessary, in the second tier portion of this process, the staff could go back and assess whether more detailed language that fleshes out what exactly might be necessary here is warranted.
Okay, Wayne?
Yes. I'm trying to think. I'm on page 58. Is that about where we're at?
Yes. Exactly.
A moment of where are we?
Good place as any.
What was that? It is a good place. Is there anywhere in here where we ask for some consideration of how this proposed long-term development plan for a particular area is compatible with adjacent developed areas, or I'm thinking in particular any areas that are adjacent to either Rockwood or actually even Beaver Cove or any of the other areas, or what the relationship is between the proposed area and the existing area. I think there's some language in here and about interconnected traffic and pedestrian ways I guess what I'm thinking in addition to that is how the development abuts, maybe what kind of economic impacts from a business. I'm concerned about, businesses in these new areas and how they're going to affect the service centers, particularly if they're close by. I just throw that out. I don't know.
Yeah, I think we note that concern, and it's a very legitimate one. The primary way we have paid attention to adjacent is through circulation, open space, wildlife corridor connections, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
We have had in our mind that there is a hierarchy of commercial activity. In the very best Urban Land Institute paradigm, there is this hierarchy that goes from the four corner to the convenience, to the neighborhood, to the community, to the regional, to the super regional centers. And they all have a role to play. They all have a very familiar mix of activities in each of those cases. They all tend to have a certain scale to them. And in our mind's eye, and what we hope would come through in the final zoning language, is that in these areas would be very much four-corner convenience center-oriented, because that's what can play off of and live off of and serve neighborhoods of 100, 200 units, that they would not be the next level up in that hierarchy, which ought to be at the Rockwood and in the Greenville and in the Jackman. But your concern, the fact that you've noted the concern, means that that should be duly noted and be part of your recommendations.
What we are not recommending here is a set of prescriptions, for example, for Rockwood. We have thought about this, whereby we direct commercial development to a particular area within that zone. Rather, we would prefer to see an approach whereby the commission, in the course of evaluating its long-term plan, sees whether all the pieces fit together at that point. So, for example, in assessing the long-term plan for Rockwood Village and determining whether there is an efficiency to the design of the plan, you might have some comments to the developer on, where the commercial hub ought to be, hub or hubs or whatever.
That sounds fine. That makes sense, I think. And I don't know whether any additional wording is needed to just reflect that. But.
Rebecca?
Okay. Traffic, is that the next? Oh, scenic.
Scenic.
We don't want to forget that, do we? Scenic standards, lighting, scenic, and noise. I see we recommend it against rock concerts, right? I basically understand the recommendation here is that we took back the control of scenic to us, right, by removing it from disallowing view corridors, particularly with amorphous language.
What we are recommending sort of at the broad scale here is that the commission develop a set of prescriptive standards that, to the extent possible, have some sense of familiarity and potentially mimic the vegetation clearing standards that are currently in place. I do want to comment here that that objective, first of all, is not intended to create a no visibility standard here. In other words, in our thinking about scenic impacts and assessing the proper location of development and making the recommendations, and really going back to the cumulative discussion that Evan set forth, we had no intention, and we still don't have any intention, of developing a set of standards whereby development from public places will not be visible at all. What we are trying to achieve here is to develop a set of prescriptive standards that provides for filtered views of the development from the resource and from the development to the resource. So it's a two-way street. And we think that that, in combination with the recommendations that we're making on the locations of development, will serve to minimize that shift that Evan was talking about from a semi-primitive or a rural roaded landscape to a rural one. With that, I do want to highlight one footnote here that I think is quite important to point out. And this is a footnote 67 on page 67, where we've laid out a number of prescriptions or elements that we think need to be part of these standards. But I do want to highlight the note that's at the bottom of page 67. We really are asking for your permission to take a closer look at these prescriptions once the standards are drafted in coordination with our scenic consultants, and potentially assess those in the field to make sure that they achieve the intended objective, that they do provide for that filtered view, that filtered protection that we're talking about here. Because this is an area where really this approach is unprecedented, and we have not been able to find any models. Our consultant hasn't been able to find any comparable models nationwide that could apply here. And we want to make sure that we do this right and that it works. So we are asking for you to consider and accept the approach that we're suggesting, this filtered view approach achieved by a set of prescriptions, and giving us an opportunity to test that out and make sure that it actually does what it's intended to do.
So you're confident in the approach that you're recommending?
Yes.
You just want to make sure that in application it does what is intended and there are no undue adverse unintended consequences.
Yeah, we want to make sure that it works both in terms of providing a filtered view for the development, because that is a critical component of making this hillside development marketable, which was clear throughout the testimony. But we also want to make sure that it provides the protections, the screening that we are, that we feel is necessary to minimize that shift.
Could you, Aga, just quickly summarize the differences between this prescriptive approach that you're proposing and that either currently exists in regulations or that which is proposed by Plum Creek?
Right now, let's start with what LURC has on the books right now. We have a general scenic impact standard that basically reads like a no undue adverse impact standard. I can pull it out, but more or less it says no undue adverse impact to scenic resources. And that what I'm referring to is Section 1025E, scenic character, natural and historic features. This is how it reads. The design of proposed development shall take into account the scenic character of the surrounding area. Structures shall be located, designed, and landscaped to reasonably minimize their visual impact on the surrounding area, particularly when viewed from existing roadways or shorelines. What we're really trying to do is take that objective. This is an objectives-based approach where the commission evaluates whether a development meets that on a case-by-case basis, and a developer could meet it in any number of ways. What we're recommending here is a set of prescriptions that operationalizes that goal, and so that there is certainty both for the commission and for the developer in the future, as to what the commission means by protection of scenic character in the Moosehead region and in these development areas specifically.
Is it fair to say that our current approach was designed primarily to address visibility from the shoreline, or as you said, from roads, whereas now we're talking about back lots, perhaps high back lots, where the scenic view for them is the primary concern, and we're looking at perhaps different types of scenic impacts than we currently deal with? Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. I think the evolution in the LURC approach towards scenic impacts it has been incremental. And our vegetation clearing standards in part were developed, the buffering requirements on the shoreline were in part developed to maintain the scenic character of the shoreline. And that has functioned quite well. And both Jim Palmer and Saratoga Associates, who did some analysis on this, agreed that that is a good set of standards to use for that purpose. And it's functioned and served the commission quite well. In those places where the development pattern is predominantly focused on shoreline development, we know that as land uses change and as development has sort of taken up, a lake frontage and conservation has taken up lake frontage, that there has been an increased interest by developers to develop within on the hillsides to capture views. This is, quite apparent in the Rangeley area, and I think is beginning and has begun in the Moosehead region and other parts of the jurisdiction. And we have this broad objectives-based approach to addressing that, but the regulations have yet to catch up to that development patterns, and the issues it creates. So my hope would be that the standards, the prescriptions that evolve out of this proposal and out of this project could be taken potentially through a rulemaking process and applied jurisdiction-wide.
Did they also include lighting standards? I mean, are we using visibility to incorporate lighting?
Absolutely. We have a pretty good set of exterior lighting standards that are already in Chapter 10 and would apply here. And Plum Creek is recommending some additional prescriptions to that, which we have no objections to.
So we're retaining our current lighting standards.
That's right.
But modifying our visibility standards.
Enhancing our visibility standards to address hillside development scenarios.
In your view, do our current lighting standards address hillside development?
Yes, especially with the cutoff fixture provision. I think it does a satisfactory job.
I'm sorry, what was the cutoff provision?
There's a provision that the cutoff, that all lighting has to be full cutoff so that you don't have,
Thank you.
I guess I just wanted to sort of chime in. I had a significant amount of, Ed said angst, I'll use heartburn, about this idea of these view corridors, not only from a scenic perspective, but the potential to be pathways to erosion, that if you if you clear the canopy and you create a corridor and you're on a hillside, everything... the water is just going to cascade into the lake. So I was very pleased to see that your proposal is to delete that. And living in Rangeley or in Rangeley Plantation, I can attest to the impact that having sort of an unregulated hillside cutting or clearing has done to the character of one particular shoreline. So I'm very much in favor of what you guys are proposing, that it's prescriptive and field-tested approach to this.
Agar or Evan, could you just speak to the on the scenic standards on the last page 68, the Lily Bay Indian Pond low impact zones? There's a statement of impose a no visibility standard. My question is, does that basically, in my mind, almost says no, that we won't allow any development there? If you, is it going to be possible to cite something that can't be seen?
Yeah, let me explain, Mr. Chairman, what our intent was there. Our intent there, and those words may not be the most artful. We are recommending that structures be allowed, albeit on a very limited square footage, 10,000 square foot, we talked about that zone, but structures be developed for right smack dab in the middle of the balance easement. It's the only place that's being proposed, on a hillside that's visible up and maybe visible down from various trails. So it strikes us there that there needs to be a heightened sense of awareness of scenic impacts. It may be on reflection that no visibility is overkill, and this may be a situation of the left hand and the right hand needing to have coordinated a little bit, but you'll notice and we'll discuss when we get to the conservation easements that there are a number of impacts that are really pushed through the mesh of no adverse impact to conservation values. And I think we could go in that kind of direction on the scenic impacts that occur to that are allowed from this low impact zone if you choose to allow structures, these, in the easement. I think we need to think of it. In other words, what we're saying is we need to think of it as essentially a small-scale set of allowable structures in the easement. And the way you're dealing with other allowable structures in the easement, you might want to think about the same way here. That's the explanation. It's not perfect, but that's our thinking.
Anything else on noise or scenic? I guess the next one is the Department of Transportation and Traffic permit. The discussion there really is around what that permit applies to, what DOT did compared to what we have to do. And I guess we're just saying in here that we have to look at a lot of other things with respect to traffic that DOT doesn't, and that they're part of the analysis, right? So.
Can I step back just for a second to 69? I noticed I had a note on lighting in the chart. And it says, it's just talking about samples, CCRs, I guess, prohibits spotlights. Now, are spotlights the same as floodlights in this instance?
That's a great catch. I'm going to defer this to Evan.
I actually thought about that very question, looked it up in the dictionary.
And?
They're opposites of each other.
I know. But I don't think people buy spotlights anymore. I think they buy floodlights.
Floodlights go like this,
yes,
and this requires those to be cut off. Spotlights are something that aimed at a specific object and illuminate that object, and those would actually be prohibited in the CCRs.
But floodlights would not be prohibited?
Floodlights would not be prohibited.
They
are
to
adding
off.
That to be subject to the cutoff feature, yeah. So it can't spill over.
All right, thank you.
(Clears throat) Is there anything, Aga, that you want to add to what on the DO, on the traffic permit?
No, I think you got it.
Okay. Okay. If that's all we want to talk about on traffic, then that brings us to the conservation easement pieces. And we start with the balance easement. Although we keep in mind that a lot of the provisions in the balance easement would apply to the legacy easement as well. And the goal is to get the language as close as we can. At least that's what the recommendation is. This is a little different. I don't know how you want to go through this, Ron. You're kind of the lead on this one.
I'm on board for this one with help from Ug and Evan. The way we've organized this, which may or may not work for you and may be a starting off point, is there are certain structural elements of the balance easement and structural elements of how the balance easement relates to the conservation framework, meaning the legacy easement, the Roaches property, and number 5 bog. And those for example, those structural elements are things like what you said. Are the terms the same between them? When do they occur? Who's the holder? Who's the backup holder? Is there a stewardship fund? All of those kinds of issues that really are the kind of architecture of the thing, I would say, or architecture individually of the balance easement, and then architecture of how the balance easement interrelates to the other proposed conservation elements. So that's kind of Roman numeral 1 with a bunch of subpoints. And then Roman numeral 2 is the really specific terms of the balance easement that are everything from the management advisory team to the amendment process to all of those things, the very specific terms that we proposed, as you saw, just in the balance easement with the suggestion, for reasons that we can get into, the recommendation that they flow through to the legacy easement. So it may be, and then there are, maybe it's a third element, or maybe it's really part of the second. There's some attached documents to, proposed attached documents to the balance and the legacy easement, which is the management plan, and then some other documents that Plum Creek attached to it in terms of how they do their forest practices today. It may be best, just a suggestion, that we talk about those big structural elements and answer your questions on the architecture, when it occurs, how they interrelate, who's the holder, and that, I think, my guess is that will probably take us towards 5:30 or not, but at least we can get your questions answered on that and your initial thoughts, and then that might set up for tomorrow, if we can't get there, getting to some of the specific terms. Why are we proposing one thing or another having to do with the management advisory team or the assignment of the easement or those kinds of very specific things?
Okay. Sounds good to me. I think that, and I guess that, are we going to be talking about both easements then at the same time here? I'm just going to follow your table.
I think it depends. I think the issue of timing relates to the balance easement and the 3 conservation framework pieces. The legacy, the Roaches property, and number 5 bog, and that may be worth discussing separate, you know, as a standalone piece.
When you say timing, you mean how these easements would be implemented?
really when they would be
when they're implemented.
Yes, because we're yeah. recommending some quite significant changes.
Yes, of course you are.
That was really presaged by the discussion this morning and early this afternoon. But it may be getting all that context straight is the place to start, or not.
Okay. Pardon me? I can't hear you. I'm sorry.
You must start.
Yeah, go ahead, Ed.
I agree with the suggestion, Ron. I'd appreciate it if he'd begin his explanation.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about, I take it we should talk about timing first and how they relate together is what you mean. Okay. As I think, I guess, the commissioners know, as we laid out the, and let's leave aside for a question, just an initial minute, the size of these easements, it'll quickly come into play. But as the commission knows, it was in Plum Creek's proposal, it is only the balance easement that is granted to the holder and put into effect at the time of concept plan approval. The other three components that Plum Creek is proposing as additional conservation benefit, which goes under the label the conservation framework, meaning the legacy easement, 266,000 acres. You know, and it might be worth getting a map up here. What you see there, Commissioner, in the light green, not the beige, not the yellow, is not the dark yellow, not the light yellow. What you see in the green and in the, yes, it's in the green only. I was looking at whether any of the, well, I don't think we need that, is the 91,000-acre plus or minus balance easement. That is the only conservation offset that Plum Creek is proposing be adopted at concept plan approval. And incidentally, concept plan approval, we take that definition, let's just put that in the bin and add some specifics to what exactly we mean by concept plan approval, but we'll come back to that. The areas in yellow, light yellow, pale yellow, do you want to, well, I think it's good enough. In pale yellow, are the 266,000-acre, quote, legacy easement, and in the far right, the 29,000-acre plus or minus Roach's property. What is not shown on this map is the 45,000-acre number 5 bog property, which is southwest. What Plum Creek proposed here as part of a purchase and sale agreement with the Nature Conservancy is that in, I believe it's 5 separate potential closings over a 5-year period. It was either 4 or 5. I can go back and check. That there was up to 5 years to close after the concept plan was approved on the Roaches, the legacy easement, and the number 5 bog, although there was a required payment very early on of, I think it was the equivalent of $15 million worth of land, so some of it would have come quite quickly. The operational effect of that is that development could proceed without some or all of the legacy, Roaches, and number 5 bog actually having been protected either by easement or fee sale. And it left, if there was non-payment by TNC or potentially by AMC on the Roaches, it left enforcement of the purchase and sale agreement to Plum Creek. What staff and consultants are proposing is that upon finalization of the concept plan, within 45 days, the balance easement needs to go to the holder, the 266,000 legacy easement needs to go to the holder, and the Roaches sale has to go all the way through to TNC and to AMC, and with some additional requirements on the Roaches property. In order, in our opinion, and it's spelled out in several footnotes, or one footnote under the legacy and one footnote under the Roaches, in our opinion, in order to satisfy various regulatory criteria. We do not feel that same way about the number 5 bog property, not because it isn't an ecologically highly valuable piece of property, but the record did not establish a nexus between its protection and the regulatory criteria. So we're expressing, I think it's fair to say, a recommendation of indifference to when that closes, and frankly, even if it does close, although it's covered by the purchase and sale agreement, so there's no reason to upset that. So that's really, I mean, there are more details of the timing, and I don't want my summation to be thought of as a replacement or substitute for the details, but that is how the major elements of the conservation fit together and go beyond what is being proposed timing-wise by Plum Creek.
Anybody have any questions, Ron? At this?
What about the roads that are to be conveyed by easement?
The roads are handled differently, and Evan will want to speak on that, and it's a good point because that is an easement piece that we don't think is subject to the same regulatory conclusion that we drew for the easement or the fee sales, and that is discussed on 113. Evan, why don't you do that?
This is a situation in which the pressures that would call for the easements on these roads to be executed, to come into play, are very much tied to actual development occurring. And so we have proposed a recommendation that a certain set of roads have their easements executed when the first 200 residential or resort accommodation units on the east side of Moosehead Lake are developed. And then another set of roads when the first 200 on the west side are developed, and the final set when another 200 on the west side. Very much tied to the fact that the demand for use of these roads is tied to the activity of the concept plan.
I do want to make note of another correction that needs to occur on this page, and that is with respect to the stretch of road from the Prong Pond, along the Prong Pond Road from Lily Bay Road to Upper Wilson Pond, which was unintentionally omitted from the list of recommendations. The gist of our recommendation is that all of the roads proposed to be eased on the east side of the lake should be the easements should be executed concurrent with approval of the first 200 units. So that was one stretch of road that was omitted from that first bullet.
That's Prong Pond. What was it?
It was the Prong Pond Road. It's the one listed under the second bullet in Plum Creek's concept plan proposal summary. But just a minor correction.
So what the timing, what the implications are of our recommendation if you adopt that on the timing is that within 45 days of concept plan finalization, and let me explain now what we mean by that term. By concept plan finalization, we mean the end of all possible appeals of approval of the concept plan. So even though Plum Creek's language in their concept plan potentially was unfavorable for the balance easement, that they were proposing that within 45 days, or within, I don't remember the days, it was 30, 45, whatever, it was immediately upon concept plan approval, as I read it by you, the balance easement would go to the holder. We don't think that's appropriate because there may be appeals, and so once those appeals are resolved fully and finally, if there are any, within 45 days and before any subdivision development is approved by the commission, you would have in place combined balance and legacy easement, which would be the largest conservation easement by just a few acres over what Commissioner Schaefer assisted in, but would be the largest conservation easement in the state of Maine. And you would also have, in effect, a transfer in fee of the 29,000-acre Roaches property to AMC with immediately thereafter some easement restrictions that would assure the uses that they testified that they wished to make of those properties would remain in perpetuity as recreation mitigation. That's the essence of the timing. And then, assuming the purchase and sale agreement goes to its fullness, the number five bog properties in the southwest there would be acquired by TNC in due course, which could be at the same time, or it could be up to the allotted time allowed under the purchase and sale, unless there were reasons that the parties eventually didn't have that happen.
I'll just dive in here. I guess my understanding here with regard to the easement is that the easements are available to serve a number of purposes within this concept, the concept plan. The first is that they are offered by Plum Creek, or at least the balance easement, to meet public benefit, to provide conservation, to balance development. That they are also made available to provide for mitigation for visibility impacts, recreation impacts, and scenic impacts.
If I may interrupt, I don't think that's how they were legally offered by Plum Creek. Plum Creek's position was that the balance easement alone fully satisfied all regulatory requirements that you might have that went to land offsets.
Right.
As additional public benefit, which was offered but not required,
right,
there was both the conservation framework lands and, we'll get to it, the additional plan elements.
Right.
But neither of those were offered for recreation, wildlife, or scenic. That was what the plan was proposed. Oh. That is not the conclusion that staff is recommending to you.
I understand that. Okay, I'm just trying to parse out the logic for the easements. Now, one of the things that we had done in the past in concept plans was we were not very specific about the purposes for which the easement, or the regulatory purposes that the easement was to meet. One of the things I think that is really important about this concept plan is that the placement of the balance easement. Now, this come a long way, because the original easement that I remember being proposed was concentrated above Lily Bay and that area there.
But the original easement was not there at all. In round one or version one of this, there was not that. I think it was around 60,000 acres
right
around Lily Bay. What you're thinking of is the second round where that was proposed in a 60,000 acre matrix block there.
But what I'm suggesting, though, is that the difference, or a precedent that it seems to me, an important and useful precedent that this concept plan establishes, is that part of the easement property is to be used to limit sprawl. It's the buffer, not to be confused with the buffer easement, but it is essentially a buffer where development is prohibited, and therefore the land transaction values won't encourage, or the buffer will prevent that from leading towards sort of a natural sprawl of development. So I think, in my view, I think one of the benefits of this approach is that it is part of the easement is directly related to limiting sprawl. The other parts of the easement, it seems to me, now I know you're recommending changes in the easement, and you're first of all, with regard to the record, it seems to me, if I'm summarizing this correctly, that you have proposed, staff has proposed, a modification in the on the ground configuration of the balance easement, but not necessarily its size, in order to accommodate for visibility mitigation. That also, it partially is to provide for wildlife mitigation and recreational mitigation. However, the information in the record indicates that while the balance easement as reconfigured by your recommendation may meet the visibility mitigation, it doesn't necessarily, or it is insufficient to meet wildlife mitigation and recreation mitigation. Therefore, at first it was considered, well, what if we increase the size of the balance easement? But the record is not specific as to how much additional acreage would be necessary to meet those mitigation requirements. As a matter of fact, some people, including Plum Creek's witnesses, implied that, well, all of these things would be taken care of if you just count the legacy easement. So we're kind of at a, and so it seems to me that what we're saying here is that we are going to take cognizance, although we're not going to require we're going to require that the legacy easement be concluded at the time that the concept plan is approved to provide the public benefit. But we're not, how am I saying this? I want to make sure I got this. We want to make, well, I won't get into the whole thing about access to legacy funds and whether it's a, how it's designated for regulatory purposes. But it seems to me that what we've got here is we've got the balance easement takes care of the buffering, so to speak. My understanding is it sort of takes care of visibility. It doesn't accommodate all the needs for recreation and wildlife mitigation. Consequently, we are taking, again, cognizance, I guess, or that the legacy easement will provide those mitigation requirements, although we're not specifying the specific acreage. Is that, am I?
Well, I think I would invite Aga and Evan to jump in here. I think I agree with most of what you're saying, but not all of what you're saying.
Please.
So let me try. And the essence of this is reduced to, and I'm going to expand on it, a footnote on page 98, footnote 91. I think the place to start this discussion is as follows. Staff and consultants felt a significant amount of sympathy for Plum Creek as they were trying to figure out the appropriate location and amount of conservation. And I went back and reviewed previous concept plans and the amount of conservation, the location of conservation, the rationale, and to use your word, the metric for the conservation, I will say to you, putting on my outside consultant hat and ducking from any arrows that are shot in my direction, I could not find a uniting and coherent theme to carry forward here other than the regulatory standards. I think the decisions that were done were a very case-by-case, what are they offering, okay, basis. And we looked at this in previous concept plans quite carefully. So as I said, the place to start, I believe quite strongly, is that you had an applicant that was proposing conservation, knowing that they were proposing development on a scale that had eclipsed other concept plans significantly, and did not have the paint by numbers, the ground rules, the place to start. That's number one. We believe there are four regulatory requirements. Three of them in the PRP zone, in the PRP subdistrict, and one of them statutorily that have implications or have bite on this issue. One, and they're all mentioned in this footnote, and I just want to repeat them because how we think of this conservation and where it should be is drawn directly from the regulatory requirements and not, you know, a wish list, so to speak. One is waivers of adjacency require comparable conservation. And we've done a lot of thinking on what does comparable conservation mean. And Evan may want to comment on this. I'll try a summary for the purposes of moving on. But we believe comparable conservation means controlling the predictable secondary sprawl, as you were saying, Commissioner Laverty, that goes from pushing out adjacency or pushing out development beyond the points of adjacency. And therefore, for instance, should you approve 400 units at Lily Bay, even within a contained zone, we think that over the course of time, it is almost axiomatic that but for protections, you will see significant hillside sprawl development as people visit those 404 units and say, this is a really nice place. How much does that hillside cost? Okay? So point number one is comparable conservation, as we're interpreting it, is essentially the control of predictable sprawl from waivers of adjacency. Our view is that the 91,000 acres in location and scale is close but not complete. So that's the first point, Commissioner Laverty, where I would respectfully say that doesn't, what your statement was, doesn't cover staff thinking. We think that there may be plus or minus, and it's very location specific. It's a mountaintop here, et cetera, boundary there. There may be 10 to 20,000 acres that could be additionally included. Coincidentally, those acres that would be included to meet that criteria are all contained within the legacy easement, okay? They are not outside of either the balance easement or the legacy easement. That's point number one. Point number two is the issue of undue adverse impact. Witnesses here, in our view, have identified the potential for undue adverse impact to primitive recreation resources, we've discussed that today, and wildlife impacts caused by development. IFNW is quite strong on this, including their latest comments in November 20th, on the need to protect the lands covered by the legacy easement to avoid undue adverse impact to wildlife, Dr. Daigle, for recreation. Again, Evan and Aga can add to this. As we said, hopefully carefully, in footnote 91, it could well mean that all the lands in the legacy easement are not required for this mitigation. But it is not clear from the record what lesser proportion of legacy easement, if anything, is required for this mitigation. Similarly, with the roaches, we believe the testimony is quite clear, the record evidence is quite clear, that protection of the roaches in the manner that AMC testified, both in writing and orally, that it intended to protect it, is necessary for avoiding undue adverse impacts to recreation, primitive recreation, because of all the attributes of the roaches that I think the commission is aware of. So that's how we got to the roaches. In addition, and I'll let Evan speak on this, there's the final criteria of a publicly beneficial balance. There are actually four criteria. The fourth one is it's got to be long-term protection of it. And a previous version of this plan only offered protection that went for as long as the term of the concept plan. So it's kind of fallen from the public vista, but the long-term in perpetuity is driven by one of the PRP sub-district regulatory requirements in our view. And Evan, do you want to comment on the publicly beneficial balance?
Yes, this is the one area where you can look to previous concept plans for some precedent and instruction, because at the level of previous concept plans, which were not landscape level, which are just based on a resource, a lake typically, or a close grouping of lakes, the idea of, and where there was virtually no waiver of adjacency. So the question of comparable conservation came into play only minimally or not at all. The one thing that people focused on was the publicly beneficial balance. And the idea we gather from those previous decisions was that in return for the benefit that the developer gets that would not ordinarily be there in terms of greater amounts of development on that resource, the public would get a balance, and assuming that was appropriately appropriately located, because remember the standard is publicly beneficial balance between appropriate development and conservation. In return, the public got conservation of the rest of the shoreline, and with public access to that shoreline. That was the basic formula of the smaller scale. It wasn't exclusively that, but that was the basic formula of these smaller scale projects. But that logic extends here too, and Plum Creek, I think, tried to hew to that logic in its earlier submissions, and it's kept to it, where the balance of shoreline that is in its control, that is not part of development areas, gets put into conservation, and that isn't for comparable conservation because of waiver of adjacency. It's not for mitigation. Rather, it's for that publicly beneficial balance. And they have added other things to round out that balance, trail, hiking trails, and the like, which we may view as necessary for mitigation, but may also be adding to the publicly beneficial balance. That is, providing something to the public to which it is not otherwise entitled, as they are able to get something to which they are not otherwise entitled.
So in terms of that's the reason why, if I'm not mistaken, that we are asked that the timing of the consummation of the legacy easement and the Roach's easement is so important here.
In our view, regulatorily, that's exactly right. The alternative possibility, some would say specter, is that development goes forward with only the balance easement. Certain recreation and wildlife mitigation is not achieved, and those deals, for whatever reason, are not consummated. And it could be for any number of reasons. We have what I now refer to as a Bear Stearns moment in the nonprofit world. We have Plum Creek deciding that it, you know, can get a better deal and may not enforce it. And so what we're saying is, in our view, with our recommendations, development can and should go forward, as we've talked about today, but only if that conservation, not the road easements, and not additional plan elements, there's the road easement, and obviously things like the Community Stewardship Fund come into effect afterwards. But on the land side, it's all there before any development is approved.
So without the consummation of the legacy easement and the Roach's easement, we would not be able to make a finding of public benefit, no adverse impact. Is that
and comparable conservation, because the balance easement is, in our view, close but not entirely there. That is our recommendation.
22,000 acres, I think, was the.
That is our recommendation to you. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
It seems it's. As we discussed before, it's part of the total package, and without it being secured, it would make it awful difficult to consider those 2,000 units we just kind of talked about briefly and said, yeah, there, maybe that's okay, right? That you and I did anyway. I don't know about the rest of the crowd, but that, for me, that without those easements, those 2,000 units certainly are become a much different number, and that certainly the testimony supports the idea that those easements have to close almost simultaneously to make them valuable. So I'm comfortable with that recommendation for because it makes the package complete. And
yeah, I think the previous discussion about how many units are appropriate all has to be seen in light of the easements. And so it's an essential
piece of the whole package. If we're going to say that 2,000 units is okay, there's got to be a lot that's a lot to swallow. So there's got to be something on the other side of the equation for me anyway. I don't know how the others want to weigh in, but.
I totally agree. The what's going to be remembered 30 years from now, probably not the buildings, but the easement. So that's the legacy we have to struggle with.
All right.
One question about publicly beneficial. There was some talk in the hearings about gravel pits and sludge disposal as almost a public benefit to the local communities that you may or may not be approved here. So does that come under public benefit, or is that just kind of an infrastructure discussion?
Great question. We can either talk about that now at the conceptual level and then the specifics when we get to the specific terms, because we are recommending some modification. But I do think the recommendation that we're proposing, which is a scaled-down version of both septage spreading and gravel use from what was possible in the easements, does fit under the publicly beneficial balance. And I think that's one very good way to look at it.
I think we can touch on the details later, but as long as it's part of the context.
Yeah. Evan, I don't know whether you want to add anything to that. It might be useful then. That really deals with, I'm on page 75, the location size of the easement. I do want to note as a footnote that while we've talked about the 91,000 acres for the balance easement, if you adopt our recommendation, there will be a few thousand acres added to that. So we might be at the 95,000 acres. If you add that to the 266, you're talking roughly a combined easement area, if you agree with the recommendation on similar terms, of about 360,000 acres. In terms of the inclusion in the PRP district, Plum Creek, and I think it would be, I'm not sure how this discussion eventually is the best way to organize it, but let me take a try here. Plum Creek proposed, if you look at, and maybe we can put up the map, Amy, if we have it, of all the conservation, so that the map you had before the different areas is the summary conservation map. Or is it just the summary map? Okay, it's the second one down. Plum Creek's proposal was that all the darker green areas, which is the balance easement, and the lighter green areas, which make up the legacy and to the far right, the Roaches Ponds tract, all be part of the new concept plan PRP subdistrict. We are recommending mostly but not entirely yes to that. We are recommending we can either talk about it now or if we're talking about it, addressing it holistically, or when we get to the roaches, maybe I'll just flag it here, that the roaches not be part of the PRP subdistrict. We feel like we're mixing a little bit of apples and oranges. We can get on to that. It's a different fee owner. Different purposes, et cetera. But at least as far as page 75 in the balance easement, we're not recommending any changes to the sub-district. For the number 5 bog, which is southwest of the map, there was never a recommendation that it be included in the PRP sub-district. The land use zoning for the balance easement, same issue for the legacy easement. I'm not sure there's anything to talk about there, but the question here is what zone applies. We're recommending, and this goes to an issue that Commissioner Hilton and others have raised, there be some changes to the permitted uses to allow campsites, for instance, in that. And
I'm trying not to interrupt your train of thought here, but I have a question.
Go for it.
Back on page 75, there's a footnote there. Could you just explain what that's all about? It sounds like you're...
Sure. This is an instance where staff and consultants are not recommending adoption of an IFNW, Maine Natural Areas Program, recommendation exactly as it is. There were certain areas of significant land size within both the balance and the legacy easement that had unique ecological attributes that they were recommending be pulled out of the easement lands and donated in fee to the state of Maine. And so not be managed as Plum Creek owned eased lands with certain forest practices and other restrictions on them to preserve their ecological values. What that footnote is about is that is not our recommendation. And the core of our recommendation, or the synopsis of our recommendation, although there's 3 steps in it, the core thinking is that an easement of the scale that we're talking about, 360,000 acres, 60% of the size of the state of Rhode Island, is going to have in it both now known and to be discovered unique natural areas, exemplary natural areas, et cetera, and the terms of that easement have to be elastic enough, sensitive enough to be able to manage those kinds of ecological situations within the easement. And the answer is not to yank them out as fee, of which this, we believe, is only a partial solution because there's going to be other areas that are going to be discovered, we believe. Yank them out as fee automatically and provide them to the state of Maine. I think, I guess we feel that that may be one solution, but it shouldn't be the only solution.
What's an example of one of those?
Aga, do you want to discuss
areas?
This?
Sure. There were several areas highlighted by the Maine Natural Areas Program in particular that where they recommended the exclusion or the fee land donation to the state. One of those areas, if you can just go to the development zone areas, was on Big Moose Mountain, the sort of upper heights of land on that mountain includes a forest community that I think qualifies as an old growth stand, which is quite unique in this region. And this was a section, by way of example, that MNAP and IFNW recommended to be donated to the state.
So what you're saying then is that you believe that it will still be protected?
Well, we're not saying that's a good question, because I do want to get into the details of this footnote. And I think in fairness to the state agencies, the reason they were suggesting that dramatic solution is, as they have testified on the record, they have not had particularly good success having those areas protected in the normal course of harvesting business. And so their reaction, they would argue, is a perfectly natural reaction to seeing, and I'm not making a comment here on Plum Creek or any other landowner, I'm saying I think their general reaction is one of concern for unique areas. So we are proposing three changes to try to meet their concerns and landowner concerns about losing a significant amount of acreage where it might not be necessary to have it donated. One is that the way the easement is written right now, all of these, or at least a fair reading of the easement, maybe not the only reading, but a fair reading of the easement term, and when we get to it, I can show you exactly where it is. A fair reading is that if these unique areas, naturally ecologically important areas, have not been identified when the baseline report is done, that's it. And if they're discovered 10 years later from a survey, it's too late. So one recommendation is to have that identification on an ongoing basis using objective standards. A second recommendation is that it does receive special management protection. And that a third recommendation is that in the second tier that we're going to go through, if you approve these recommendations or some other, that very specific language be worked out as determined by the staff and then coming back to you with a specific recommendation as to the nature of that special protection so everyone understands what can be done. So it's not, on the one hand, it's not saying, yes, this has to be protected by fee, and that's the only way, if you take it as a given that these are old growth or very unique areas. On the other hand, it's not saying, don't worry about it.
So, Ron, will it be the responsibility of the easement holder then, to, as the steward of the property, to protect that?
Yes, these unique areas would be defined. The management plan would say the type of harvesting practices that would be allowed in known and to be discovered special management areas. That's how it would be handled.
And as they are discovered, will the easement be modified or an addendum added to it or something?
I think the management plan would be modified, and that would be one of these implementing pieces of language among many once we get direction from you, if that's
all
what
right.
you want to do.
Yep.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But that's, Commissioner White, that is a primary example of what an easement holder would do to ensure that that and other harvesting practices are adhered to. Okay.
How much of this easement area has been adequately inventoried? None? 10%? 50?
Inventoried from this point of view, this aspect
yes.
that we're talking about?
Yes.
I think NMAP, the Maine Natural Areas Program, would tell you some, but certainly not all, in terms of the level of specificity. And their testimony is that, and one indication of that, Commissioner Schaefer, is that their testimony is that when on the development side, not talking about the easement area, but on the development side, when a particular subdivision comes in front of you, they want to make sure that the applicant has to do that very specific inventory on the development side. I think they're feeling that there's been some inventory. There was a contract around 2000 with Plum Creek to do some inventory, but the sense we get is between that inventory and the field work the woodlot did, they know some but certainly not all of it, which is, I think, what's behind their concern that there be this ongoingness to identifying that area.
I just want to note, to back up Ron's explanation, response to you, that Woodlot Alternatives was contracted by Plum Creek and to produce a natural resources inventory over portions of this easement area, and it's contained in a very large notebook, I think dated 2006 perhaps, and that is available. But I think they and everybody else would admit that that was not a 100% inventory.
And their focus was really on the development zones.
And just for clarification, there were several reconnaissance level survey, surveys, sort of walk-through surveys done of the easement lands, one in 2006 and then an addendum to that in 2007, both for the development areas and the conservation areas. And the level of detail is at that reconnaissance level, if that's helpful.
Page 77, I think this makes sense to talk about this next, where we talk about the holder of the, your recommendation, the holder of the balance easement and the legacy easement should be the same entity. Sounds like a good idea to me. And also you're also saying that it should be a state agency, preferably DOC, Bureau of Parks and Lands.
Well, let's take them one at a time. In terms of the holder of the easement, we do believe that if these easements are to be managed as they're going to have the same terms and everything else, that, you know, you're not, going back to the map, you're not looking at a map where if you draw a vertical line down from Moosehead Lake down the middle of Greenville, you have one easement on one side and one easement on the other. You have the balance easement that is, you know, almost intermixed with the legacy easement. So we believe that there should be one holder for both. That's number one. Regarding the who that holder is, we set forth two options, we believe. And we tried to explain our reasoning for both of those options here. The reasoning for a state of Maine entity is really captured in footnote 75. And I'm not going to repeat it. That was our effort to spell out that rationale. Having said that, there are both policy and operational reasons where you could choose a different entity to be the holder because of its mission focus, et cetera, although we do believe that these easements are so imbued with public values that their public accountability of how that other holder is operating would need to be significantly addressed. So that's the essence of what you're seeing on that page.
Ron, I this is an area where I strongly feel that the easement holder should be a public entity because, as you suggest, of the tremendous public rights and the need for public accountability involved here. And I mean no disrespect whatsoever to the Forest Society of Maine or Alan Hutchinson. I certainly don't mean to apply that. I just think that This is not, I mean, there are easements and there are easements. Well, you talked about one that's been reasonably consummated through the efforts of Commissioner Schaefer. But those are, in a sense, private easements by private or quasi-public entities, and they're not to achieve a public benefit in exchange for extraordinary development rights. So it seems to me that this public interest, it's important that this public interest be realized and protected in perpetuity as the easement runs in perpetuity. The public entity at least has a reasonable probability of existing in perpetuity. A private organization may come or go. Also, the function, the mission of a private entity or quasi-private entity may change over time. I mean, I am quite concerned that the primary easement holder here be the Bureau of Public Lands or some appropriate state entity. And I see where you're going with suggesting that if a private entity become the easement holder, that the third party backup holder should have the same rights as the initial holder, in that the backup holder should be able to take action in order to enforce the terms and conditions of the easement if the easement holder, the primary easement holder, is either unwilling or unable for financial reasons or a change in mission to do so. So I'm very concerned here about this. I think it's very important to recognize that this easement arrangement is distinctly different from other easement arrangements and is imbued with the notion of the public trust. And I'm very concerned that public responsibility be, in order that the basic deal here that's represented by a potential approval of this concept plan is protected over time. That's my position.
I'm not convinced that the easement is so different from any other easement that's held by any one of the various land trusts around the state, nor am I convinced that the state has the capability to monitor all of the easements that it has. I would think the state would need to be the third-party backup, no doubt about it. But I don't think I'm ready to jump in and say that a private land trust couldn't do the job.
Do you think that the state, the backup landholder, should have the same rights of easement enforcement?
Oh, sure,
as the primary easement holder?
Because that's why the third-party holder is there. The third-party holder has to pick up the ball. If the primary holder of the easement doesn't do the job, or more likely, if for some reason the primary holder ceases to exist, then the state would pick it up. But I think the state would have to hope that all of these 100 land trusts that we have around the state don't go out of business, because there's a lot of work out there.
Well, I can understand your concern about preserving public land trusts, and they really have a major role to play in the state of Maine. It's just that this easement is different, in my view, in that it is being offered in return for extraordinary development rights. And therefore, in order for that public benefit to be realized over time, there has to be assured public accountability.
That could be reached in a different way than having the state be the monitor, though. I mean,
possibly,
under the funding pressures, the state and the manpower, I think they'd be hard pressed to effectively, steward a 400 some thousand acre easement at this point.
I would suggest that maybe the Forestry Society of Maine might be in the same position. I mean, I think we need to talk about, a stewardship fund or a fund associated with maintaining the easement.
Right.
I guess what I'm concerned about as I understand it, the original proposal was that the third-party backup easement holder would operate more in an advisory capacity than any kind of meaningful capacity of oversight. So, I mean, if I could be assured that that was in fact the case, I might, whether it's held by the state initially or not,
just might be less important,
but I mean that to me is absolutely a crucial, that a public accountability notion here is very crucial.
Just to be clear on our either or recommendation, I turn your attention to two things. First of all, footnote 76 on page 77, where our recommendation is, if you want to go in the direction of a non-state entity, the holder, that it go further than simply the backup holder having the same rights as the primary holder. And the reason is this public accountability issue, and that a third party holder, which essentially has no funding, we are recommending should have the right to replace the holder if BPL or another state agency determines that they're not adequately performing. So it doesn't have to be year in and year out, please do what you're supposed to do. At some point, given that this is in perpetuity, the state of Maine under the public accountability function would say enough is enough. You're out of business, or you're not competent, or you're not doing your job, and there needs to be an alternative holder. So that's one point I want to make, not one way or the other, but just to clarify the other part of our recommendation, because I think it is, we're recommending, you may not agree or none of you may disagree, that it go further than just putting the holder in exactly the shoes, the third party exactly in the shoes of the holder.
So you're saying the third party would be responsible for ensuring that a competent holder was there?
Absolutely.
But not have to be the
Absolutely. And that there would be performance standards and everything
that
else.
That makes sense.
Secondly, though, we are proposing, regardless of who the holder is, that there be a stewardship monitoring enforcement fund. And so to the extent you don't want to go with a state agency because they don't have sufficient funding, I think that's a problem that can be cured by having that fund remain, quote, offshore at the Maine Community Foundation so that certain hungry legislators don't use it for other purposes. And Alan Stearns has, not that that ever occurs, of course, and Alan Stearns has testified that that is a structural arrangement that they are already using. So our view is that the funding issue and the state not having the funding could be solved. That doesn't get to some of the other issues that some of you are raising, but I just wanted to clarify that.